explaining in detail just the first step for solution to the brain function in yesterday's web breaking problem. This your choice of how you were Fourier inverse Fourier transforming.
Right. So. So we had something like an equation box on G, which was function of R and T, and this was delta R, delta T. So now what I'm doing, I'm writing G, R, and T as the inverse Fourier transform of, so it's 1 over 2 pi to the 4, D4, I used K, hopefully, and then G, so instead of R, I will be writing K. So if you want, you can write it like that, K, and instead of T, I'll be writing omega. And then what stands here is E to K times X, which means, okay, K times X. Let's put it like that. But now K, I take to be omega and the K vector. X, I take to be T and R. And the scalar product here, I'm choosing so that it has actually a Lorentzian signature. So it's minus k0, well, this is 0 component, this is 1, 2, 3. So k0 times x0 plus k1, x1, well, okay, plus k2, x2. And plus k3 x3. But now this is nothing else. So k0 is omega, so it's minus omega times t plus vector k times vector r. So this is what I'm doing. And then so I write it like that. Then I expand the delta function using the formula I derived two lectures ago. And then simply pull this box operator through this integral. So this doesn't depend on. So this box operator acts on R and T, but this guy doesn't depend on that, this guy doesn't depend on that, this guy doesn't depend on that. So the only thing which actually the box acts on is this exponential. So I pull it through that so that I get a box on G equals to everything I have here, 2 pi to the 4, D4K, G. And then I have box acting on e to minus I omega t plus I k times r. That's the left-hand side. And the right-hand side is the function, well, the integral representation of the delta function is 2 pi to the 4 d4k e to I. And the same thing, the same exponential. So. The same exponential as on the left-hand side.
I was just concerned with the details of the first step. So it's like you start off with G as a function that you inverse Fourier transform. So
yes.
You perform an inverse Fourier transformation on that. So I expected, no, actually not quite, because if you're inverse Fourier transforming G of R, comma T, then G of R, comma T would be in the integrand. So what I said is incorrect. You're not inverse Fourier transforming G of R, comma T, but rather you're representing G of R, comma T as an inverse Fourier transform of G of A, comma
W. That's right. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Other questions?
Thank you.
Okay, so now let me start. Well, I would like to do two applications today. So one will be to quantum field theory, so advanced stuff. And the other one will be even more advanced stuff. It will be about gauge theories, counting the degrees of freedom of gauge theories. But hopefully it will be simple enough. And the first, actually, this application of quantum field theory is just for you to realize that you actually will see Green's functions everywhere in quantum field theory courses. So that's why I'm doing that. If you don't catch up the details, don't worry about that. But just to know that you are to expect a Green's functions in quantum field theory. So the first, let's call it propagator. And let me just recall some of you might have seen already that you can formulate quantum mechanics through the path integral. So basically write something like a partition function of the path integral dq of t exponential I over h bar L to t dt L q and q dot. So this guy here contains all the information about quantum mechanics. So this is a path integral, or if you want partition function, this is integral measure. So that's something complicated. People usually don't care about what it is exactly. So we don't have to be worried about it now, but it's something complicated. Then I, h bar, we are in quantum regime. And this guy here is just a classical action, is the classical action. So as an example, S. Usually the action is denoted by S. And for example, I can have 0 to t dt 1 half m q dot square minus v of q. So I have kinetic energy for the particle, and I have the potential energy for the particle. So it's just a classical action. So this guy contains all the information about quantum mechanics. So who hasn't seen that before? Not bad, not bad. OK, so just take it for granted. So basically what you are saying is that if something complicated is happening here, but it's weighted by this exponential where there's a classical action. So yeah. So basically, if I have two, well, the particle can go from one point to the other point. This is t. This is q. Then in classical world, it just chooses one trajectory, which actually minimizes or extremizes the action as one trajectory. In quantum world, you can follow many other paths, but they are not equally probable. And the probability is actually weighted by this exponential thing here. So it's less likely that the particle will travel like that than it would travel like that, and so on. That's what it means. Yes?
So when you say that T encodes everything about quantum mechanics, do you mean everything about a particular quantum system?
Yeah. I fix. Well, quantum mechanics, you just describe, for example, one particle and some potential well or whatever. Yeah, so you fix the system, and which gives you the classical action for the system. And then this contains all the quantum effects. Yeah. So now let's do something more fancy, which is the quantum field theory. And actually, it is exactly the same thing. So now Z is not called path integral, but it's called functional integral, because it's a functional of the field phi. But anyway, otherwise, it is precisely the same thing. So now my unknown, so there my unknown was the particle's trajectory q. Here my unknown is the field, so d phi e to I over h bar. Now we are in space-time, so we don't only have time, but we also integrate over the space. So that's why d4x. And then there is Lagrangian density for the field phi. So this guy, again, is the classical action. Action for the field phi. Okay, and let's just give me I'll give you an example. So let me take from now on just h bar equal to 1 so that I don't have to carry that. I could also set I equal to, well, let's keep I. Okay, so then I have d phi, and I'll just expand what this could be here. So it's d phi exponential I times d4x. And an example of an action for the scalar field is just minus 1/2 d phi square minus 1/2 m square phi square minus some potential for phi, which can be arbitrary at this point, and then g x phi x. So that's a particular example of what the Lagrangian density of phi can be. So now, maybe you know that this guy here, so this is the mass of the field. This is the kinetic and potential term of the field. And yeah, so and this gives me the mass. So this is basically free field, which means that it's a non-interacting field. The field actually has some mass and sits in the vacuum somewhere, but it doesn't interact with itself. So that's the free field. Now the potential may contain, well, the potential describes interactions of the field. And if I had only these three terms, actually everything would describe only vacuum. So it would describe if I have, well, field in vacuum, what it can do. So we know that there are some quantum fluctuations, so it can create some particles of the field. They can, again, die after some time. So this will be just vacuum. But of course, I want also to have possibility to insert some particles, like an external source. So this term, this guy is the source. So if I want to inject a particle of phi at the beginning, then precisely this J term does that for me. OK. So just the terminology. So L is the Lagrangian density. So there it was just, well, L, big L, is Lagrangian. This is Lagrangian density. Basically, it is big L over the volume density. And I'll be also using this notation that this derivative here is the special relativity derivative. So it has four components. It has d0, which is dt. And then it has just the normal Nabla operator, which we've seen before. Yes?
I'm just wondering, is there any motivation for putting the action in the exponential?
Well, it works.
Why did you choose to do
that? There is a derivation of these things. So maybe did you derive this in quantum mechanics, just starting from usual Schrödinger equation? Yeah. So you will derive that. Don't worry. Yeah. And actually, going from here to there is also pretty simple. You just consider a matrix of these things, and yeah.
So the action in the exponential comes from a derivation.
It comes from a derivation, basically. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Well, you have to wave hands a little bit, but it is a derivation. Yeah. Well, in the first case, I would call it a path integral. In the second case, I would call it functional integral, because actually it is a function of phi, but that's a function. So it's function of function, so it's functional of phi. Functional integral. Okay. Yeah? The source is, for example, really, I have vacuum, and now I want to put there by hand that there is one proton or whatever. I want to put there particle. So this term does that for me. So I can choose J so that it creates the particle or destroys the particle. Yeah, it's just a convenient, yeah. OK, so we have that. So now classical equation of motion for the field. In Lilia's lecture, you have seen Euler-Lagrange equations. I hope you have seen them for the fields as well. Did you? Yeah, OK. Good, so then you know that the Euler-Lagrange equations are the Lagrangian density over delta d mu phi minus delta L over d phi equals to 0. So this is Euler-Lagrange equations. So specifically for free field, I just take the first part of L. minus 1 half d phi square minus 1 half m square phi square. And so now I plug that in. So I first have to differentiate with respect to d of phi, so which gives me two of these terms. And then I differentiate once more with respect to d. So this gives me d times d of phi from this term, this guy here. And then minus, minus is plus. And then I differentiate with respect to phi, which is plus m square. And I have minus here. Plus m square phi equals to 0. So that's my Euler Lagrange equation. Or in nicer form, it's just d square minus m square times phi equals to 0. And how is this equation called? Klein-Gordon equation. Perfect. So it's Klein-Gordon equation. So this would be the classical equation we would govern. Yes? Right.
And I can't write quickly enough. What precisely does phi represent?
Phi is the field. So you can look at your space, and well, it's an entity like electromagnetic field. So you look through your space, and at every space-time point, you look at the value of the field. So for example, it is the temperature in the room. So here the temperature is 5 degrees. Here the temperature is 3 degrees,
so
and so on. It's a scalar field here. Yes.
And in your free field expression for that's the Lagrangian density of the free field?
Yes.
Okay. It looks as though the del phi is in a bra vector.
That's del phi is what?
Is it in a bra vector? Yeah. What's
it? Well, it is this guy here. So it is it's a four vector and it contains dt and nabla. It's d phi square,
okay,
so it's d phi times d phi. It's a scale product. Yeah, that's bracket. Sorry.
Yes.
That's bracket. Yeah. D phi times d phi. Yeah. Good. Other questions? Okay, so that's the classical thing, but of course there are quantum corrections, and they are all captured by this functional integral. So this would be the classical, well, if I can solve this equation here, I have the classical behavior of the field, but that Z captures also the quantum effects. So in the same way, some other things contribute to the actual result. All right, so now what do I want? Now I want to calculate Z, and let's do it for the free field theory, but with the source for free fields is the source. So I just forget about that interactions V phi term, and that's what I want to calculate. And in order to do that, I just look at this integral, and you have d phi, so you have term precisely we're asking about, so d phi times d phi term, and I'll integrate it by parts, so I will shift one of the derivatives from this guy, let's say, to the other guy. So now I assume that there is no boundary term or whatever, so in the end I will get phi times d, which is d square on phi, is minus sign, so I'm integrating by parts. So by parts, I get that Z equals to integral d phi e to the I d 4 x. So now the minus sign is plus 1 half phi. And I have d square minus m square phi plus j on phi. And that's the integral I want to calculate. And let's call it I. Or Z, or doesn't matter. Okay, integral. I want that. Everybody happy so far? So now, remind. So first step is remind something. You had the whole course on Gaussian integration. So if you have multiple integral dq1 dqn of the exponential, and now you have a vector q times the matrix times the q. So this is a matrix now, n times n matrix. And then you have ai times j times q. So this equals to 2 pi I to the m over the determinant of the matrix A to the power 1/2, the square root of that, and the term which you have to complete the again the squares and so on. So you pick up the term, and the term which you pick up is minus I over 2 j times, now the inverse of the matrix A, so A times A minus 1 is 1, times J. So this you hopefully know. Let me just stress that this guy here is the inverse. Matrix. So now comes the fun. I was trying to convince you that this integral is precisely that integral there. So you have something quadratic in phi there.
Yeah.
So what stands in between phi must be my matrix A. And J, Q is the same. So if I identify Q with phi and A is the differential operator, then I'll have exactly the same thing. So I can just stop here, but let me try a little bit harder. So I'm saying phi is my vector, A is the matrix. So now, using this bracket notation, which I showed you two lectures ago, I can use that x and z eigenvectors form the complete basis. So I'll put one inside. I've put one here. Then I have A. Then I put another one in terms of Z. And phi. So of course, as usual, I will call this phi of Z. I'm in real numbers. Phi is real for this case. So this is phi of X. And this is, of course, the matrix evaluated, well, it's the matrix element of A, X, and Z. Right? Okay. So now I want to compare what is over there. So I know that it's an integral over X of phi of X, now this d squared X on X, and phi x on x. So what does it mean? That I have to identify this matrix, A, x, and z. So now there are two integrals here, over x and z. So I have to kill one of them. So I have to insert the delta function there, killing one of either x or z. So I'm saying this A, x, and z must be delta x minus z. And then the operator I want, which is d squared minus m squared. D squared, let's call it d squared in terms of the variable x, minus m squared. So if I do that, then indeed this thing, so this delta function kills one of the sum, one of the integrals, and only one integral remains. So then indeed I have d this equals to d4 of x phi d squared minus m squared phi. Right? So I had to identify this matrix A, this differential operator here. Okay. So I identify that I is that operator which I want. So what I need to, in order to use this formula, is actually to find inverse of A. So I need to find an inverse of this operator. So need inverse to A. Usually the inverse is called A to minus 1, but not in this case. It is called D. So this inverse I will call D, and it's A to minus 1. Okay. And then what this thing has to satisfy, so I take again the matrix element, and now I take A and D, which is of course 1, and Y. So this guy is 1 by definition because I am having an inverse. Okay, I again insert unity, so I have x, a, z, z, d, and y. I have inserted unity here. So now I use what my differential operator here is. So it's delta x minus z and times this operator here, right? So it's t squared of x minus m squared. So, and the delta will kill this integral here. So it's delta squared minus m squared. And now this is just d of z minus y, but the delta will say that x and z are the same. So it will be d of x and y. D of x and y. Everybody happy? Who is not happy? You are not happy? Why you are not happy?
Doing for the last step.
The last step. So now I'm using that this guy here equals to that guy. So it has the delta function x minus z. So it tells me that z is equals to x. Z equals to x. So that's why I have dxy here. And then, so that this delta function kills this integral here. The sum over set, but what remains is this d squared minus x squared. Okay, so that's using that thing, but I also know that this is actually 1 by definition. So this must be equal to x, 1, and y, right? Because that's the definition of the inverse. So that's x and y, but I know that it's delta x minus y. So in other words, we have derived that this inverse to A satisfies the equation d squared minus m squared dx minus y equals to delta, now I'm in 4 dimensions, x minus y. All right, that should be quite familiar. So in this context, D is called a propagator. But we also know that it's nothing else than the Green's function, right? Something, some operator acting on something gives you delta function as the Green's function. Yes?
Sorry, just I missed it. Could you explain why A is just delta x minus z in A? there a definition or a setup?
Oh, right. No, no, no. So I want. So I want that integral. So I want used to this formula, basically, to that integral. So I want to identify A with this d square minus m square, something like that. Well, OK. So the matrix element of A, I want to identify with the integral phi d square minus m square times phi. Yeah, so I want to have that equal to that. So how do I do that? So I'm calculating this. So now I have to insert two unities, which gives me two integrals over x and over z, right? So then I have phi z and phi x, but I want this guy to be equal to that guy over there. So I have to kill one of the integrals, because there's only one integral upstairs, but two integrals here. So I have to impose this delta x minus z so that I have the same dependence in phi. I have phi x and phi x, not phi x and phi z. That's why I'm inserting that guy here. And then I want what stands in between to be d square minus m square. So that's why I'm putting that there. So I really want these to be equal, waving hands. Yeah.
There, should we
integral? Yeah. So this is what I did before. So if you prefer sums, that's fine. If you prefer integrals, that's fine with me as well. It's the same thing. The only thing is that it's really a sum only if you have some boundary conditions. If you have finite piece of space, then inside the x is actually quantized, and that's why it's real sum. But if you have infinite space, these sums are actually integrals. So, yeah. Okay, so we have propagator. So once, okay. So once we identify that, so once we know this propagator, once we know that, then, so once D is known, you can write what Z is. So Z, and now let me write it very clever. So Z definitely depends on J. So, but you see that in this formula here, there's something standing in front of the exponential, which doesn't depend on J. So let me call it Z at J equals 0. And then I have the exponential. So this equals to Z at 0 times the exponential minus I half. I'm using that formula there. Now J is phi. But you see there is a scale product of these things. So again, I have to insert unity there. So I'll have two integrals, actually. So this is d4x, d4y, J of x, dx minus y, j of y. So if I know what my propagator is, I solve my problem, basically. I know what the partition function is. This is for the free field, yes?
What is the significance of the propagator in this case?
I'll discuss that. Yeah, I'll discuss that. Sorry? It's basically, let me answer. So you're interested in, so you create something at this point, at this time, and you're interested what is the amplitude, what is the probability to find the particle which you created here at x and t later?
So the probability in this case plays the same role as the probability in, or as the propagator in more recent quantum x.
Yeah, it's the same thing. Okay. Yeah. Basically the same thing, yes. But now I'm actually talking about fields. So I create the particle of the field here, and then, yeah. Okay. So how much time I have? 10 minutes. Perfect. So this is more or less clear, or more or less confusing? Confusing.
Why did d of x comma y switch to d of x minus y?
Ah, very good. Just because of the symmetry, so you can always show that the propagator must depend only on the difference of these two things. So So I didn't show that. I didn't show that, but you can show that from the symmetry. Yeah, good question.
So what is z of 0?
Oh, it's... If you look at this formula here, you have the exponential which depends on j, and then something which stands in front of that,
right,
which doesn't depend on j. So I call that what stands in front of that j for j equal to 0. So
right,
is that j equal to 0?
What is the determinant of a in our case?
Yeah, it's this determinant of a and something. Yeah, usually this actually, this thing actually diverges and it's a bad thing, but people don't care about it. So the path integral always, you know, you always encounter infinities and so on. But what actually they claim that the physics depend on is only this exponential. So basically, everything I don't like, I throw here, put here. Yeah, that's how it works. Okay. Yes? How I did get j x dx minus y, j y. Okay, again, it's this scale product there. So I have j times a times j, which means I have to insert two unities. So I have to put, so what it means is j a j, right? That's what it means. And then I have two sums over x and y, and then I put j x x a y and j, and so this gives me jy, this gives me jx, and this, well, okay, I have d here, dx minus y. Good. Now, can I put it up? Maybe I can. So, just a few remarks. So if you look at our integral I, well, it's an exponential which has I in it. So it's something which is oscillating. So you need to actually make sure that this thing converges. And people, how people do that, they say that actually I need something which would actually dump my oscillating exponential. So for I to converge, we replace m square to m square minus I epsilon, where epsilon is some small positive number. So if you see there, I have minus m square, which means there will be plus I epsilon, but I have another I there. So the whole thing will be dumped by this positive epsilon. It's e to minus epsilon times phi square. Something manifestly dumping the exponential. So that's one remark. So now another remark which you will actually do yourself in the tutorial today, that you can solve for d. So I told you, once we know d, we know everything. So we have to solve for d. And then, of course, using the Fourier transformation. So again, let me use the same trick as I did yesterday. I Fourier transformed that equation. It's basically the same calculation as we did yesterday. But now we have m square in addition to what we had yesterday. So it's 1 over 2 pi to the 4 d4k. Now dk So obviously, solving for dx, because it depends on x minus y, but let's solve just for the difference, x minus 1. So dk, I have d square minus m square plus I epsilon, so that my integral converges, e to I k times x. That's on the left-hand side from that equation there. And on the right-hand side, I have to Fourier transform delta function, or more precisely, write the integral representation for the delta function d4k e to I k times x. Right? Everybody happy with that? We are already experts in that, yes?
What's the argument for adding an imaginary small component?
Okay, so I need, so that integral there, that exponential there, is oscillating. It is I something, it's sines and cosines. So that's bad. So I need to actually.
What's the physical argument there? Why are you allowed to add imaginary mass?
Well, you know, physics can make sense only if the mass makes sense. So
so you're saying there is an imaginary component to our mass.
So actually, people spend their lifetimes trying to prove that that integral doesn't exist. And it doesn't exist if you put it like that. So you have to make it exist. Because we know that the physics works, and we know that actually if you use this integral, it gives you the experimental things which you see. So that's why you basically put by hand this thing here. That's my answer to that. Okay. So now, this guy picks ik times ik, which is minus k square, minus m square, plus I epsilon. From where we conclude that d of k equals to minus k square, minus m square, plus I epsilon. So that's in the k space. That's my solution for the propagator. And that's basically all you need in your quantum field theory calculations. So usually these are done in the k-space. Yes?
Would it be exponential of
k
x minus y?
Yeah, it should be x minus y. Yeah. So now, yeah. Let's try to find dx, and then I can always write, instead of x, I can write x minus y, because it depends on your own. Yeah. Thank you. Good question. Okay, so now I don't want to do what you will do in your tutorial. So what you need to do is go back now to, so for quantum field theory calculations, this is enough. This is all you need, actually. But let me just, to see some properties of this propagator, let me go back to X space. So go back to X space. So we need to do the integration, but not the whole integration as we did yesterday, but just integrate over k zero. So let me remind you that I write k as k zero and the k vector, which I did write there already, x as t and x vector, and that I use this scale product. Where there's first minus and then plus, 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 plus. So in particular, k square, what is written here, is minus k zero square plus k square. Let me also define omega k to be square root of the vector k square plus m square. So that's all I need. So now my d of x equals to the integral d4k over 2 pi to the 4 e to I k times x divided by k 0 square minus omega k square plus I epsilon. with all these definitions and with all that. And that's where your work starts in the tutorial. And you'll be asked to show that if you integrate, so this is integral over the vector k and the integral over k0. So now I want you to integrate only over k0 using the residuum theorem or whatever. Ah, I deleted this. I didn't want to delete that. So I claim that, so integrate over k0. And I claim that the result is t of x minus I v3k over 2 pi to the power 3 2 omega k, the quantity I defined over there. And now two exponentials, e to minus I omega, minus I omega k times t minus k times x. And that's only when t is positive. So this theta function is 0 for t negative. It's 1 half for t equal to 0. And it's 1 if t is positive. Right? Plus another term, which is exactly this, almost the same term. I don't know if I'm missing minus. Hopefully not. Omega k t plus k vector times x vector. And this is for t negative. So you will derive this for me in the tutorial. So now the question you were asking, what this dx is. So let me just write it in words. This is an amplitude for a disturbance a. It's in the field. Field to propagate. From the origin because I chose this y equal to 0, so that I'm just constructing dx, but if it were dx minus y, it would be from y, not from the origin. From origin to x. And what is actually nice that this depends crucially on whether you are inside the light cone or whether you are. So you know that from special relativity that if you have something happen here, and this something can influence only, so this is time, this is x, and this is the light cone. And you know that if something happens here, it can influence things only which are inside the light cone, right? It cannot influence something which would happen very, very far. Well, here. Okay, so it's not the case if you take into account the quantum effects. So depends on where you are on the light cone. Yes?
So when we say depends on where we are on the light cone, do we mean
Yeah, if you are inside the ice cone.
Do you mean that D depends on whether the x value in that previous sentence is in the life?
Exactly, yeah. So I create something here, and then I ask, well, this is an amplitude for a disturbance to propagate from the origin to x. So now, depending on whether x is inside the light cone or whether the x is outside the light cone, you get different behavior of this thing. Okay, so just to see, take x to be t and 0, so t is positive. So in this case, I am inside the light cone, so that should be fine. So, yes.
That is the light cone that has at its apex the event of the propagation leaving the origin.
So you create something here in the origin, and you ask how this disturbance propagates to some point. So whether I can find some information about the disturbance here or there or.
That's right.
You can say that. Yeah. So now I'm inside the light cone. And so if you look at here, so t is positive, so only the first term contributes. I take x to be 0. So I have only this exponential e to minus I omega k times t. So it's something which is I inside it. So that's minus oscillating. So in this case, it's superposition. Position and the exponent is the plane wave, so it's the superposition of plane waves. Which means, well, it's the oscillatory behavior. But if I choose x to be 0x, so now I'm outside the light cone, you can show, and I will not show that, I'll refer you to something else, that d behaves like e to minus m times the magnitude of x. So it's actually exponential decay. So if you want to see this, see the book by Z, it's called Quantum Field Theory in a Nutshell. And I put it into the references. And section 1.3, well, actually this derivation is done. Okay, so this means that, so classically, this you wouldn't know anything outside the light cone. But here, you basically see something up to the distance 1 over m. So there is a leak of the field outside the light cone. So classically, a particle cannot get outside the light cone. But the quantum field can leak out, basically to the distance where this is not very tiny, leak out over a distance. Something like 1 over m. So if you go much farther, this exponential will be very, very tiny and you'll dump everything. So quantum mechanics allow you to go outside the light cone. OK. So the last remark. So I derived this propagator from this functional integral thing, which is the quantum field theory course number 2, which you will take here. But before that, you will see the same propagator in the quantum field theory course number one, where actually you will not hear about path integral, but you will hear about canonical quantization of the fields. And then there you will see that this I d of x is equal to the vacuum time ordering the field at x, field at 0, and the vacuum. So how you actually read this in canonical quantization is you start with the vacuum, you create a field at 0, you destroy it at x, and this gives you the propagator. So just you will see this first. Questions? So I need that.
Hey.
Yes, Miriam?
How exactly in this formalism do we then prevent propagation of information faster than light speed?
That's very good. Ask that question to your quantum field theory lecturer. And basically, the answer is that well, Feynman had an idea, but Feynman and Dieler had idea that actually it's an electron. Well, always you have one electron which propagates normally, not the other electron which propagates backward in time, and
yeah,
so
and
on.
A positron is an electron.
Yeah, yeah. So it's something to do with that.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, we have 15 minutes, which is not enough. Are you really tired? Yes.
So what we defined, there we defined D as the inverse of A. But so is the D the same thing in the path integrals? Is also D there the same object?
You mean this canonical formula here, or?
Well, no. So you had a big D in your
right.
original formula. Is it the same D?
T.
No, D.
D.
The 1D operator, the other symbol in the path integral. He's asking whether they are the same.
The symbol in the path integral. Where do I have symbol in my path integral? That one, there. Yes, it's the same thing.
No. The symbolic notation for the path integral is D something. Big D something.
The measure
in
the path integral.
Oh, yeah, it's not the same thing, of course. No, it's not the same thing. It's a different thing. So the measure, okay, let's try the measure with scale D. And yeah, so this is something else. This, yeah, the propagator is not the measure. So sorry for my notation. So the measure is some measure. It's some horrible thing. You don't have to care about it. But you have to care about this D here. So degrees of freedom, and now I'll be in again, I like D, so in D dimensions. Meaning in D space-time dimensions, so space dimensions D minus 1, and time is 1 dimension. So first, scale field is very simple. So I derived for you that the scalar field classically satisfies this Klein-Gordon equation. So this will be now classical thing. So I forget now about quantum field theory. Just classically, how many degrees of freedom you have. So now, you Fourier transform that. So I write phi of x to be d to d k over 2 pi, now in d dimensions d, phi of p e to the I k times x. That's what I'm writing here. So if you plug it there, you get the same equation as we did before. So from there, you see that this pickups ik square, so which is minus k square, minus m square. I forget about minus because it's equal to zero anyway. So it's k square plus m square on phi p phi k, sorry for that, phi k equals to zero. That's in the Fourier space. So now I have two options how to satisfy this equation. So first option is, what if k square plus m square is not equal to zero? What then? Then phi must be equal to zero. Then phi k equals to zero. And of course, if phi is equal to zero, that means there's no degrees of freedom here. So zero degrees of freedom. But I have another possibility when this is satisfied. K square plus m square equals to zero. Just writing again k to be k0 and the vector k. And now let's say that k0 is usually denoted by the energy. So it's E and k vector. So this guy is nothing else than saying that E square equals to P square plus M square, which you probably are familiar with. And this has a fancy name. It's called Musselle condition. Musselle condition.
Why is it called that?
Sorry? Because mass has, well.
Well, why the shell?
Anybody has answer to that?
Just be completely unrelated, but I think in the original derivation of the renormalization procedure for the relativistic classical case, they assigned a negative infinite bare mass to the electron to cancel out the mass that came from the self-interaction.
So okay.
There was like a field mass and the actual physical mass.
I don't know. I don't know. Well, anyway, so here we have just one scale field, so we have 1 degree of freedom, and that's only when this mass shell condition is satisfied, when this condition, k square plus m square equals to zero, is satisfied. Yes?
I would think it's because for every m, you have like a sphere in momentum space.
Right.
Either you're on it or you're off it, and if you're on it, you satisfy the mass shell condition.
Yeah, so maybe that could be that. Yeah. That you are not inside that shell, but what you are exactly on that shell. Yeah. That's a good guess. Okay. So now that was the scale field. So now situation much more interesting if you have gauge field. And by gauge field, I mean everything which has gauge degrees of freedom. So there is, you describe it by something, for example, electromagnetism by the potential A and phi, but there is still some gauge freedom. I can still kill some of the degrees of freedom there. So gauge field. And it can be gravity, it can be electromagnetism, it can be Jungdahl's theory. So there is a rule. So in any gauge, in any gauge theory, the number of degrees of freedom, real degrees of freedom, equals to the number of the apparent degrees of freedom minus twice the degrees of freedom of the gauge function. basically, you are saying, well, each gauge function can be used twice to kill some unwanted degrees of freedom. So in particular, in electromagnetism, you know that I have A and phi, which is in total four components. And I have one gauge function, which is this lambda function I wrote yesterday. So that has one degree of freedom, it's one function. So the real degrees of freedom is, here it's 4 minus 2 times 1, which is 2, which precisely corresponds to photon either going that way or that way, circling around, or the polarization there and there. So it's only 2 degrees of freedom of the electromagnetic field. OK. So that's the general rule. Now, how you would derive that, I'll show you one explicit example how to do that. So to show this explicitly, let's use something which is, you may be some, yes?
Does this rule also hold for a massive gauge
freedom? As long as you have gauge freedom, yes. I don't know if you have gauge freedom. If you have massive vector field, you don't have gauge freedom, I guess. Yeah, so as long as you have gauge freedom, yeah, it works. Use light cone coordinates. Horrible name. Light cone coordinates. Something which is very useful if you want to quantize things. In string theory, you will use that all the time. So on. So basically, so far, I was writing my vector as k0 and k. So now I'll be writing any vector. I will specify two things. I will have a plus, a minus. And now I'm in d dimensions. So this will be, well, a0, a1, a2, a3, a4, and so on. So this is that. And what is nice about this light cone coordinates is that the scalar product in them, if you have two vectors, is something very weird. So you take minus sign because I'm in Lorentzian space, but you take a plus, b minus, minus a minus b plus, and then the usual thing. So it's something different. So we have minus a0, b0, and then we have pluses. So now you have actually a mixture, plus, minus, minus, plus, and the rest is plus. And of course, this corresponds to the fact that I'm choosing my metric b0, minus 1, minus 1, 0, and then normal 1, and 0 here, and 0 there, and 0 here. That's precisely equivalent to that. So again, it's just how I define my scalar product. And you can always do that.
Sorry, so A is four dimensional?
Sorry? A, so I'm in D dimensions. So
D dimensions. So AI
yeah.
has D minus
D two. Minus two.
Okay.
D minus two. Yeah. Very good. So and this actually it's a very useful trick how to extract the real degrees of freedom. And I will show that on the Maxwell case. So we already know that the Maxwell case has 2 degrees of freedom in 4 dimensions. I claim that in any dimension it has d minus 2 degrees of freedom. So C is the Maxwell case, but now in d dimensions. So we know that it's described by electromagnetic potential A mu, right? So now it obeys the equation which I derived. So it's d square A mu minus d mu d times A. So this is in special relativistic notation. I derive it in normal notation, and I said I imposed the Lorentz gauge where this thing was zero, d mu a nu was zero here, but let's keep it there at this point. And you know that this guy is invariant under the gauge transformation where I take delta a mu to be d mu or some function which I called before lambda, but let's call it chi so that we have different name. Okay, so this is the gauge function. So now counting the degrees of freedom. So how many degrees of freedom a mu has in d dimensions? How many components it has? D. So this guy has d components. This is just one function, so it has one component. So the number of degrees of freedom is, using that formula there, it's the apparent, which is d, minus 2 times 1, which is d minus 2. So that's the number of degrees of freedom. So how to see that explicitly? So writing, again, this is a course on Green's functions, Fourier transform. So I Fourier transform that. So writing a mu of x in the Fourier picture, so d to d p 2 pi d again, a mu of p e to the I p times x. And if you do that, so you're interested how this equation looks like and how that equation looks like. So you know that each derivative is replaced by I times P. So I will have P square here minus, and I will have P mu, and I will have P times A here. So this equation, the equation of motion, translates into the P square A mu minus P mu times P times A equals to 0. That's my equation of motion. And delta a mu equals to, so now the derivative goes I p mu, so I p mu times I. That's the Fourier thing of what I had. Okay. So I'm plugging this guy here to this equation there. So basically each derivative, so again, I'm differentiating this guy here. So nothing depends on x except this exponential. So for each derivative, I'm taking down I and IP. So that's why I have two derivatives here. So I have IP times IP, which is P minus P squared. This guy gives me pi mu. This guy gives me P times A. Yeah, it's that. Yeah. So we are now almost done. And look at that beauty now. So it's sticky. It's interesting. So let me choose that P plus is not equal to 0. And this is without lossless generality, so I can always rename my components of the p vector so that one of them will be non-trivial. Otherwise, I have trivial vector, and I will just call it p plus. So if this is true, then The other equation there, this gauge transformation equation, gives me that delta A plus equals to I times P plus times chi. So I can always, so if I started this non-trivial A plus, then I can always choose chi such that A plus will be 0 in the end. So choose chi so that A plus equals to 0. So we have used our gauge function once. We killed one degree of freedom of the field. But we can actually do more. So everybody happy with that? So now I use my equation of motion. So let's take that equation, the first equation there in the box, and take mu equal to plus. Then I have p square a plus minus p plus times p times a. And that must be equal to 0. That's my equation of motion. I'm just using mu equal to plus, right? But I arrange for a plus to be 0 in the previous step, which means p plus times the bracket must be equal to 0. But I assume that p plus is non-trivial. So from here, the only conclusion is that this guy must be 0. Yes?
For massless vectors, p squared is already 0.
Not yet here. No.
This is not on shell yet.
This is just, I'm just discussing the equation of motion and its gauge degree of freedom, but not yet. I'll come to that. Yeah. So I conclude that P times A must be 0, right? That's the only possibility. But what does it mean? So now I have to write down what P times A is using my weird scale product rule. So this is P plus minus times A minus, minus P minus A plus, and plus PI AI, and this must be equal to 0. That's my weird scale product rule, right? So now I know that A plus is equal to 0. So this guy is not there. So I can solve for A minus from here. So A minus equals to 1 over P plus PI AI. So you see that not only I know A plus, but I also know A minus in terms of A, the other A's. Right? So really, I have like killed 2 degrees of freedom. But let's have a look what is left out of our equation. So now I know, so this is my equation here. But I derived that P times A must be 0. So what remains out of our equation is P squared times A, these guys, is equal to 0. So I have an equation P squared AI equals to 0. That's what remains from the equation of motion. And now I come to what you said. So I have 2 possibilities, right? Either I'm on shell, meaning that P squared equals to 0. If that is the case, these are arbitrary numbers. Everything else is determined. A plus is 0. A minus is in terms of these AIs. So I have D minus 2 degrees of freedom encoded in these AIs. Or I am off shell, which means P squared is not equal to 0. And then, of course, these guys must be 0. So then I have 0 degrees of freedom. Isn't it beautiful? So two remarks. So the first one is, you mentioned that p squared equals 0. So what if p squared is not equal to 0? So without doing any of these analyses, if p squared is not equal to 0, I can take this equation and divide by p squared. It's non-zero, so I can divide by it. So when p squared is not equal to 0, I can take that equation and divide by, so divide by it. So I get that a mu equals to 1 over p squared p mu p times a. All right, so this is something very suspicious. I'm claiming here that if p squared is not equal to 0, then I have 0 degrees of freedom. But here I found beautiful a mu. So what's wrong? What's wrong with that and a mu? How can it be? Well, if everything is fine, this must be a pure gauge, right? It doesn't describe any electromagnetic field. It's just a pure gauge. And indeed, you can show that this guy is pure gauge. And you can get rid of that by choosing chi to be minus I p times a over p squared. If you choose chi that, then get rid of this gauge field. And finally, this is the remark for those who have seen quantization, second quantization of fields. So one photon state would be described by I 2 to d psi I a I Dagger. So I'm creation operator on the vacuum, and this has components p plus and pi. So this would be called a polarization vector. So polarization vector. So this is only a remark for those who have quantized fields before. So I create one photon from the vacuum with the given helicity state or polarization vector psi I. And then you see that I can create only these big letters I because the other ones are already determined from here. So everything is known. So you have d minus two helicities of the photon in d dimension. And that's the end of this mini course. Well, thank you so much.